So I have to admit, I do feel bad for the poor press that the Pharisees often receive. As I read articles and commentaries about these interactions with the Pharisees that we read in our scripture today, everyone seems to be emphasizing that they were opponents of Jesus, that he's trying to do his work, and that they keep on challenging him. I think it's sort of ingrained. In our Christian attitudes. I know when I first read these passages, that was how I interpreted the interaction. There's sort of an innate bias against them. But as I read it again in preparation for this sermon, I couldn't help but ask some questions about this particular view. So let's talk a little bit about who the Pharisees were and why there is some tension there. First off, the Pharisees were a powerful group. But their power didn't rest in the hallways of government or in the authority of the temple. They were actually more of a populist movement. The Sadducees were the ones running the temple. They were the aristocrats. The Pharisees were lower class than that. They were all over Judea and beyond. They advocated a program of national revitalization, of national renewal. They wanted to do that grounded in a stricter observance of the law. They opposed the Roman occupancy and the violence that it carried with it. And their legalism, their strict adherence to religious law, often it can be seen in contrast to the growing influence of Hellenism. So when I say that, I mean, you know, ever since Alexander the Great did what Alexander the Great did, everywhere was trying to become more and more Greek. And that included Judea. And the Pharisees were kind of pushing back against that. They were saying, well, no, we shouldn't be Greek. We're Jewish. That's who we should be. What defines us as Jews? Well, we follow the law. Now, Jesus and later Paul do in fact challenge this strict adherence to the law. Their opposition to strict legalism at the cost of love would seemingly bring them into direct conflict with the Pharisees. But the role of the Pharisees in the New Testament, well, it's far from clear. Yes, immediately after these passages, they talk about joining with the Herodians, that's the king, the ruling family of Judea, to plan how to kill Jesus. But we get a contradiction to that in the Gospel of Luke. In chapter 13:31, it says, "At that time, some Pharisees came to Jesus and said to him, 'Leave this place, go somewhere else, because Herod wants to kill you.'" For a group that's supposedly antagonized by Jesus, this doesn't really fit with any understanding that all of the Pharisees wanted to kill him. And it gets murkier in the book of Acts as well. After Jesus dies, twice it's the Pharisees who come to the defense of the apostles. First, in chapter 5, the apostles are arrested at the orders of the high priest. And when they're called before the court, the high priest finds they're not in prison. They've been led out. They're in the temple grounds teaching. But they do. They get hauled before the Sanhedrin, which is the religious court of Jerusalem. And the members there, they want to put them to death. They want to, you know, stone the apostles. But it's the Pharisees, specifically a Pharisee named Gamaliel, who gets up and he says, well, if the work these people do is human in origin, they're going to fail just like everyone else. But if it's from God, well, we don't want to be fighting with God, so why don't we just let them go? And they do. Later in chapter 26, Paul is on trial before the Sanhedrin, and it's the Sadducees who want him dead, but it's the Pharisees, either A, knowing that Paul believes in the resurrection like them, or perhaps also knowing that he was once one of them himself, it's the Pharisees who advocate on his behalf, who are arguing that he should be free, that he should be released, that he shouldn't be put to death. So as I read these passages, I couldn't help but notice that maybe the Pharisees here aren't really challenging Jesus at all. I mean, in the first story, Jesus forgives the sins of a paralytic man. And there are some scribes who see this and they think to themselves, well, how does he do that? Only God can do that. Isn't this blasphemy? I don't think it's unfair for them to wonder what's going on. Jesus suspects what they're thinking. They don't even say it out loud. Jesus says, I know what you're thinking. And he teaches them. It's a teaching opportunity. In the second story, Jesus is seen eating with people who maybe he shouldn't be eating with. Jewish purity laws could be interpreted pretty strictly. And so the Pharisees ask, well, why is he doing this? Is it a problem to even ask that? Again, it's another teaching opportunity. All they did was ask. And in the final story, someone points out that John the Baptist's disciples and the Pharisees all fast. They ask, how come Jesus and his disciples don't? But really, what's wrong with that? The big controversies in these passages, and these are often called the passages of controversy, is that some people are asking, how come Jesus does things the way he does? And that's about it. What's going on here? And I don't see that as too much of a problem. Now, I don't mean to say that Jesus didn't challenge the Pharisees at all. I don't want to say that many of the Pharisees didn't have a problem with Jesus. I simply want to point out that the relationship is far more nuanced than we might suspect. In fact, there are some who have read these controversies and see two things that I want to point out because they're both kind of interesting. The first is that debate was the primary way of communicating and teaching and learning about Torah and the law. Rabbis could and did get together to debate how best to follow the law and how following the law gave everyday people a way to encounter or interact with God. The Pharisees challenging Jesus and Jesus challenging them back, well, that was considered normal. That was what people did. Everyone did that when they wanted to learn, when they wanted to teach. It wasn't someone getting up and lecturing, sort of that Industrial Revolution model of teaching. It was an engagement, a discussion, a back and forth, a debate. And secondly, there's some indication that Jesus may have been a Pharisee himself at one point, or at least very closely connected with him. Arguments have been made that even in this passage, the familiarity and yet surprise that can be heard in the Pharisees' questioning of him, their curiosity about why he doesn't follow the rules, certainly leaves open that possibility. Furthermore, there was arguably one of the greatest Pharisee teachers who lived and taught not too long before Jesus' ministry began, named Hillel. He taught the golden rule as the heart of the law. So to say that Jesus' ideas were foreign to the Pharisees or that what he was proclaiming was super new, it's not entirely accurate. We have to wonder if our view of the Pharisees is shaped by what happened between the Christians and the Pharisees not long after Jesus' death. So just as a quick aside, when the Jewish revolution broke out, the first Jewish revolt broke out, and Romans came in and they slaughtered Jerusalem. And before that happened, there were a bunch of different sects of Judaism. There were the Sadducees, who were the aristocrats. They were in a relationship with the Romans. You know, they were kind of tightly knit. There were the Pharisees. They were the teachers of the law. There were the Essenes. They were sort of a monastic group. There were the Zealots. They were the ones who were really fighting against Rome. And then there were the Nazarenes. And that was the group that would later become the Christians. But after the destruction of Jerusalem, after the destruction of the temple, well, only two groups were left. There were the Nazarenes, who would go on to become the Christians, and there were the Pharisees, who would go on to become rabbinic Judaism as we know it today. And that's where the tension really seems to start. And you have to wonder if perhaps some of this anti-Pharisee language used comes out of the tensions that history ascribed to these two groups as they were arguing for domination over Judaism and what Judaism would become. To be honest, this story to me and the relationship between Jesus and the Pharisees speaks a lot about spiritual growth. It describes to me a sort of natural spiritual development that all of us are invited to. I remember when I was a kid, I carried a fear of God, a significant fear of God, a fear of God not in the biblical meaning of fear of God, but like I was afraid of God. I was afraid. I remember once my parents had a devil's costume for me to wear, and I was terrified to wear it. I wouldn't put it on because I was scared of what that meant on Halloween. I was worried about hell. I was worried about condemnation. I'm not sure where that came from, as my family isn't really very religious at all. And if I'm honest, I still think I carry some of that within me. I suspect all of us do in some way, maybe not the idea of a condemning God, but I think we all carry ideas of moral rectitude, of what is right and what is proper. We all carry ideas of how we are supposed to be, of how we are supposed to act. And we get these lessons from our families of origin or from our society, or perhaps we write them ourselves based on our experiences. They form our worldviews, they form our habits, and they form our way of being in the world. There's another name for this. This is our ego. Often this is what this is called. It's our ego. It defines who we are. It's this rigidity, these boundaries, these rules we create or follow that help us to work and move in the world. They create our identities. They help us forge some of our early relationships. But to borrow some of Richard Rohr's thoughts on the matter, we spend the first half of our lives building up those walls, building up the foundation, building those definitions, those habits, those worldviews, defining who we are, so that we can live in the world. We need that ego to help us navigate the world. But then we spend the second half of our lives, well, trying to take those boundaries right back down. Richard Rohr emphasizes this a lot in any of his works on the two halves of life. And the idea of two halves of life is a helpful one, though I think Rohr himself would be the first to say it's limited. Especially when we assume it's sort of like flicking a switch, you know, oh, I am now in the second half of life, everything has changed. It's more nuanced than an on-off switch. None of us are ever fully in one space or frame of spiritual development, and then we move entirely to another. That's just not how it works. It's more nuanced than that. And I also think there are many people who are in their 70s, 80s, and older who still exist in that first half of life mentality, that rigidity, that ego-driven understanding of the world, those habits, those worldviews that direct and guide how they see everything. We know them, or at least we know of them. They might even hold high office. That being said, as I was working on this, I was thinking of someone who I knew from my chapter's Guelph days. And his name was Aaron, and he was only a couple years older of me at the time, so he was in his early 20s. And he died this past week, I'm sorry to say. I won't pretend that I'm closer to this heartbreaking death than I am. I hadn't spoken to him in years, but when I read on Facebook that he died, I couldn't help but think of who he was at such a young age. I always saw him as an incredibly deep and profound man, not because he had tremendous wisdom to share, but he just had a genuinely good heart, and he was just genuinely loving, and that just radiated off of him. He was a good man whose priority was kindness, goodness, compassion, and care. So to say, you know, at around the age of 40, you switch into a different mode of being, that's just not accurate. If we look at not just this story, but the relationship between Jesus and the Pharisees, or at least the way the Gospels portray the Pharisees, if we look at through a mythic psychological lens, it makes sense to me to see the Pharisees as a sort of symbol of our egos, especially if Jesus was once closely affiliated with them. They were a formative part of who Jesus was. The ego helped bring Jesus to where he was. It helped define him and blossom him into the early stages of adulthood. The ego, which is defined by rules and laws, perhaps socially constructed, perhaps internal ones that we create for ourselves to live in the world. But no matter how socially unacceptable they may be, but the Pharisees seem to give off this sense of a group defined by rules and laws. So like our egos, the Pharisees of the Gospels shouldn't be considered bad, perhaps just limited. Even Mark's description of their desire to kill Jesus can be read mythically as the ego's desire for control over the self. Its desire to limit the part of ourself made in God's image, to limit the fullness of our humanity. Not necessarily because it's bad, but in large part because it wants to protect us. Just like the Pharisees, they wanted to protect Israel. They wanted what was best for Israel. They cared about the community. They were longing for a sense of national revitalization. What I think is important in this text is the final verses that we heard today. No one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old cloak. The patch pulls away from it, the new from the old, and a worse tear is made. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the wine will burst the skins, and the wine is lost, and so are the skins. But one puts new wine into fresh wineskins. Jesus isn't condemning the old wineskins. He's just saying they don't really work anymore. The spiritual growth of moving from one state of being to another, from one worldview to another, doesn't condemn the other. It says, well, that's helpful to a point. It's limiting, but the new worldview tries to incorporate that, tries to draw that in, tries to integrate that into a new, more full understanding of the way things are. We can look at Jesus. While the legal rigidity of the Pharisees is not overt in his ministry, though it is present if you look for it, the appreciation for the depth and breadth of scriptural study, his embrace of the law, his desire for a rejuvenated Israel, of a kingdom of heaven here on earth, these are hallmarks of what his ministry became. Jesus knows exactly where he came from. He knows exactly what a gift that has been. But he's also very much aware of its limitations. So I don't see him as condemning the Pharisees. He's just grown to encompass a worldview larger than what they offered. Hence the phrase, I didn't come to abolish the law or the prophets, but to fulfill them. This is why I like Paul. Paul is a great example of a Pharisee who's grown to encompass something beyond just the law. In Philippians 3, he writes, if someone else thinks they have reasons to put confidence in the flesh, I have more. Circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, in regard to the law, a Pharisee. As for zeal, persecuting the church, as for righteousness based on the law, faultless. This is why I love Paul. He gets away with writing this stuff. He's like, yeah, I was pretty amazing. And he always finds ways to do that in his letters. Yeah, I was pretty amazing. He is not apologetic about this at all. Yep, that's who I was, and this is who I am now. He's not getting rid of the law. He's just saying that the law in and of itself is limited, that it's useful only in certain situations. He's not abandoning his own ego. He's not abandoning those rules, those habits, those regulations that all of us write for ourselves as we grow up, as we find who we are. He's just encompassing more of himself. He's integrating more of himself than what his ego provided, than what those early steps of maturity offered up. What life and experiences he's had have shattered those views and said, okay, we need to think bigger than this. So So while all of us seek to develop our spirituality, while all of us seek to develop in our relationship with the divine, as we long to engage with the holy or to recognize when the holy engages with us, I'd invite you to do so with compassion for yourself. Compassion for who you were. Not just a desire, oh, I want to be better. But to say, okay, who I was brought me to this place. That's where I came from. That defines who I am as an adult. And now it's just time to take the next more encompassing steps. And what an opportunity that holds for all of us to build a deeper relationship with the fullness of who you are and the fullness of who God is. God not based on rules and regulations and being right and proper, but a God grounded solely in the gospel of love. Thanks be to God. Amen.